2 years ago this month, Hurricane Sandy changed from a tropical storm in the Caribbean to the largest hurricane on record to hit the Atlantic coast.
Our next guest chronicles the 9 days when Sandy ravaged the eastern seaboard in her new book.
Catherine Miles is a journalist and the author of Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. Catherine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So when Hurricane Sandy began its approach to the U.S. coastline, did scientists know what they were in for, just how devastating the storm would be?
It took a few days, really. About a week before the storm, we had one model that was showing that it would make landfall in the mid-Atlantic. But the National Hurricane Center uses about 40 models for their prediction. And the 39 were really saying that the storm was going to turn out to sea. So it wasn't until about 4 days before the storm made landfall that we really could say with any confidence that the storm was going to hit. And I think a lot of people were really surprised by just how weird and wonky and non-hurricane-like it was when it made landfall.
And when the outlier came up, I think you're right that the people looking at it said, oh yeah, this is the one thing we know won't happen.
Right, right. I asked the meteorologist at the Mount Holly National Weather Service office that in New Jersey, and they said, you know, it just seemed so ludicrous to us at the time. Like, you know, this would be bucking every possible historical trend. But we soon learned very quickly that, you know, hurricanes love to buck trends.
Well, the storm had a bit of a track record already as it came in from the Caribbean. What did we know about what it had done already as far as its potential?
Well, that's part of what was so unusual about this particular storm is that it began as a very sort of typical traditional hurricane down in the southern Caribbean and followed all the rules of a late season hurricane. But there was a series of unusual circumstances happening meteorologically that caused it both to veer straight towards New York and then also to collide with this nor'easter and create this hybrid storm that soon got dubbed Frankenstorm.
Before we pick up the narrative, you talk some about just how difficult it can be to predict what hurricanes are going to do, where they're going to go, and how powerful they're going to be. What is our state of the art in that now?
Well, you know, meteorologists are quick to sort of say that we still have a long way to go in terms of our weather prediction. They're pretty good at tracking where the storm is going to go. There's still a lot of really minute, sophisticated science involved in terms of storm intensity. And I was really amazed at the number of meteorologists who said to me, you know, look, we're just not very good at this. And then further compounding it is the fact that, you know, these meteorologists are really hemmed in terms of resources, training, funds. You know, they're working double time for not much money with, in some cases, really outmoded equipment. So, you know, in some cases, they have the odds stacked against them.
Has a lot changed since Hurricane Sandy when it comes to storm prediction? Maybe have we figured some things out technologically?
One very significant change has happened. When Sandy collided with that nor'easter and became this hybrid storm, the National Hurricane Center was quite literally incapable of issuing advisories, watches, and warnings for the storm. They told me that they really worried that their software might literally break when this happened. And so in the 11th hour, we saw this really sort of messy decision-making process where the National Weather Service ultimately decided that what they would need to do, since the National Hurricane Center could no longer issue these watches and warnings, is hand over responsibility to regional National Weather Service offices. And they did a heroic job in attempting to sort of carry the burden of the National Hurricane Center, but it really wasn't part of their job description to do this, and it created some confusion in terms of communication. Immediately after the storm, I think nationally, we all looked at this and thought, you know, as one hurricane specialist told me, that was maybe the least lousy of four really lousy options. And so meteorologists across the country got together and made a very decisive decision to sort of extend the ability of the National Hurricane Center. So now the next time we confront a hybrid storm, the National Hurricane Center will be able to issue these watches and warnings, and hopefully that's going to save a lot of lives.
You also tell the story of governmental decision-making. Now, this is a huge decision make to, say, evacuate New York or take other drastic measures. If you evacuate a major city and the hurricane doesn't hit, you've created a lot of maybe unnecessary trouble. What What was the story there in New York City deciding as this thing was approaching how to react to it?
This was one of the most chilling moments in the story of Sandy. You know, all around New York, we saw these very rapid, aggressive evacuation warnings. Connecticut, Philadelphia, Delaware, New Jersey, of course, issuing evacuation warnings very early on in the process. Mayor Bloomberg felt like the information he was receiving suggested to him that the storm would be no worse than Irene, which made landfall indirectly a year earlier. And there was this very sort of bizarre moment in the chronology of the storm where he staged a press conference less than 48 hours before the storm made landfall, where he told all New Yorkers that it was fine, it was no big deal, that city employees should report to work on Monday, and residents should just weigh down their trash cans with a brick. And that created this media firestorm where meteorologists on the Weather Channel, people at Weather Underground, meteorologists on local news stations were just sort of pounding their chests and saying, how could he be so wrong?
Is part of this, you know, maybe both on the part of meteorologists, but also on the part of governments, mayors, sort of magical thinking that they don't want to believe it could be this bad. It's never been this bad before. Why should it be this bad now?
And this is a problem I think that we as a country really face. And this was something I really wanted to unpack in the book. In a lot of ways, the book is a narrative of the specific events surrounding Sandy. But in some other ways, it's really an examination of how, as a country, we deal with risk and also how we deal with an infrastructure crisis. And when I pose this question to social scientists who specialize in risk management and assessment, what they told me is that as a culture, universally, we devalue the risk that natural disaster poses. We think we're much more likely to be involved in a terrorist attack or a nuclear disaster than we do in a really threatening weather situation. And I think time and time again, we've been shown that that actually is not true.
We're talking with Catherine Miles. She's the author of the new book, Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy.
We're reflecting now on Hurricane Sandy, which ravaged the eastern seaboard 2 years ago this month, and we invite you to join the conversation. Our guest is Catherine Miles. She's the author of Superstorm.
What do you think can or should be done to improve the nation's weather forecasting and emergency response system? Were you there on the eastern seaboard when Sandy was approaching? Do you remember what you thought? Do you think we're too slow to evacuate in the face of hurricanes and other natural disasters in this country? Do we take them seriously enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Catherine, a lot of your book is personal stories of people whose lives were impacted. And one is the captain of a ship from Booth Bay, Maine, who had to make a decision on this clear morning at the beginning of all of this. Skies are clear. The sea is calm. This captain had to make a decision about whether or not to set out to the Atlantic. What happened?
This is the Bounty. It's the recreation of the HMS Bounty, the very famous story of the mutiny, and it was made for the 1960s movie starring Marlon Brando. And the captain considered himself a very traditional seafaring captain. He loved to turn off all the technology on the boat so his crew could learn to navigate by the stars. And, you know, he looked at the weather. The boat had been through several hurricanes before. And he made the decision that he could get out and either get around the storm or make it through the storm. The ship sank very tragically off the coast of North Carolina. Two individuals, including the captain, died. And in a lot of ways, for me, the story of the Bounty became emblematic of the story of so many of us when we're faced with a threat or a risk or disaster and the decision-making that we go through, really, that we just sort of assume we're going to be fine. And I think it's echoed in a lot of the people who chose not to evacuate, in the decisions of people like Mayor Bloomberg. And I really hope it asks all of us to consider how we confront risk.
And you also tell the stories of what happened in hospitals affected by flooding in particular related to the storm. What was happening there?
When Mayor Bloomberg and the city of New York finally did issue the call for evacuation on Sunday, October 28th, so about you know, 24 to 36 hours before the storm was going to make landfall, the city made the decision not to evacuate its most vulnerable citizens, the people who were in nursing homes, residential care facilities, and hospitals. They had done that during Hurricane Irene. They felt like they had put these patients at an undue risk because of that, and so they decided to have people shelter in place. No one imagined that we would have the swath of disaster that ultimately affected New York. And for these enormous hospitals, including Bellevue, they were soon without power. Tragic stories of patients who were on life-saving devices that suddenly went dead. Heroic stories of nurses and maintenance workers working together to evacuate patients. Everyone from premature infants to 300-pound people with heart failure down, you know, 18, 20 flights of stairs. In some cases, the patients remained for days and days and days in a situation not unlike what we saw in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. And there are multiple lawsuits currently underway in New York City because people feel they were mistreated during the storm.
We go to a caller now. Bill is joining us from Tomahawk. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My comment is that during both the New Orleans and the New York disaster, I never heard anybody ask for help and give specific details on where you could go to sign up or to be considered a helpful person. I'm an RN. My license was current. I would have been willing to help in either instance probably, but there was no way that I know about, and I don't know anything on public radio where they ever ask for volunteers.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Bill. Appreciate your comments. He's getting at that he feels that it was hard for people to assist, that there might have been large groups of people who flocked to the cause of aiding either of these situations, but it was hard to figure out what to do.
As citizens and as the public, we tend to really undervalue risk. And in a lot of times, I think we really just sort of tend to ignore what forecasters and scientists are telling us. In that same press conference that Mayor Bloomberg had, he told the citizens of New York that President Obama had offered the assistance of FEMA, and he told the president that that assistance wasn't needed. There's a kind of hubris that we seem to suffer from that seems to suggest we don't need help, this isn't going to happen to us. And we also, I think, tend to be a lot more responsive than we are preventative as a country. We tend to be more likely to bring in FEMA or the Red Cross after a disaster rather than really invest in the infrastructure that will prevent that disaster from happening.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Our producer, Galen, was in Lower Manhattan during the storm and for the following week. He says it was an unreal experience, no heat or hot water, no grocery stores, no power for over a week. And he says it seemed ridiculous that people only started preparing really the night before and they had to close grocery stores to prevent stampedes. Does that fit into the story you were just telling, Catherine, of we don't want to think about it until it's already on top of us?
That's right. And in the case of New York, by the time evacuation orders were issued, residents of New York were given fewer than 8 hours before mass transit were closed. They were given fewer than 6 hours before transportation for people with functional needs and disabilities was closed. And in fact, a major, very, you know, sort of foundational class action lawsuit was just settled against New York City, saying that people with functional needs were disproportionately disaffected by the storm and not able to get out. So I think what this is going to do is really cause a lot of communities to rethink their emergency management plans and their willingness to act in advance of the storm.
Catherine, is part of this also that, you know, as a country and maybe as a world, we're not always prepared for superstorms, super tornadoes, hurricanes of this size, and that it's something we're all catching up to as the climate changes?
We are, and this goes back a long time. One of the issues that I explore in the book is the fact that we have consistently underfunded the meteorologists who are doing the heavy lifting for our nation. When you look at the history of the National Weather Service and the history of NOAA, you see a history of a lot of politics involved that have nothing to do with weather and nothing to do with meteorologists. So while we have these very talented and hardworking forecasters and meteorologists, they don't always have the funds and the tools that they need. We've chosen as a country to allocate our resources elsewhere, and we're ultimately in what is really an infrastructure crisis right now. And my view is that if we don't really start making some really aggressive injections of funding into these weather programs, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Have you seen any kind of change like that since Katrina, since Sandy, or are we going to have this conversation again after the next big storm?
I worry that we're going to have this conversation again. I think really as taxpayers and voters, we have a real responsibility to sort of shake our elected officials and say, look, you know, we invest in all sorts of things, you know, as a country, but we're not investing in one thing that is immediately tied to both our personal safety and our national security, and that's our weather system.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Catherine Miles, a journalist and the author of Superstorm, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress. We'll talk about how the legislature is changing as more women and minorities join its ranks.
But first, while the world's attention has been riveted on Ebola in recent months, a new report out today from the World Health Organization says there's another infectious disease that should be on our radar, tuberculosis, and the global burden of TB is higher than previously estimated.
The WHO says the new numbers can be attributed in part to better data collection. They estimate that 9 million people developed TB in 2013, 1.5 million died from it.
Mandy Slutsker joins us to help put these numbers in perspective. She's Senior Associate for Tuberculosis at ACTION, a global health advocacy partnership. Mandy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
The World Health Organization says the number of estimated cases of TB has increased because of change to their data collection methods. Can you talk about where the difference comes from and how these numbers may be more accurate?
Yes. So it's not that there's more of TB than before. It's just more that we know about now. Previously, all of the data had been collected by countries that report to the World Health Organization the number of people who get TB in their country. And this year, with support from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, as well as USAID, there's been funding for new surveys called prevalence surveys in countries which use a more rigorous analytical method to try and track new cases of TB. And they've discovered that we've been wrong the entire time.
Now, TB isn't a disease that is on many people's radars, at least in the United States, and hasn't gotten the headlines that Ebola has gotten. Why is it significant that 9 million people estimated to have it worldwide?
It's significant because it is an infectious disease that spreads through the air when infected people cough or sneeze. And each person who's infected with TB usually goes on to infect an average of 10 to 15 people each year. And because we're all connected by the air that we breathe, TB anywhere is TB everywhere. And it doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't respect borders, and it affects people in the United States and around the world.
How would you compare tuberculosis to other infectious diseases around the world in terms of severity and mortality rate?
TB is among the most severe, and it kills 1.5 million people each year. The thing that's different about it is that it is preventable and it is treatable, and it's atrocious that we allow 1.5 million people to die each year from a preventable and treatable illness. Another thing about TB is that it's been consistently underfunded and underprioritized, which is why the disease keeps outpacing our attempts to control it. In the report that you mentioned, the World Health Organization reports that there's a $2 billion gap to fight the disease. And it's time that our government and the governments of the world come together to invest more in fighting tuberculosis.
How do you treat and prevent tuberculosis?
So you prevent tuberculosis in the same way that you would prevent the flu, in that it spreads through the air, so it's important that infected people, you know, cover their mouths and get on treatment. You treat it using a combination of different antibiotics that are taken for about 6 to 12 months. And if you're anyone like me, you can imagine I have trouble remembering to take a daily multivitamin. So taking an antibiotic, let alone multiple antibiotics, every single day for 6 to 12 months is quite difficult. And one of the reasons why the disease is so bad is because it is difficult to treat, and it's causing a lot more problems than if it was just like strep throat, where you could take a simple course of antibiotics.
Why isn't TB getting the funding that it needs globally to fight it?
I think it's because TB is a disease of poverty. It has been historically, even though anyone can get it. And because it's a disease of poverty, it makes it easy to ignore. It doesn't affect most of us, so we don't think about it. But really, it is a disease that is a major problem in the world. And it's unusual in that it can live in your body without giving you any symptoms. And a third of the world, that's about 2 billion people, are walking around right now with tuberculosis bacteria in their body. And each year they have a 10% chance of getting sick with active disease. So it's really important that we take action now.
If someone has a case of TB that's gone untreated, what are the symptoms?
It's usually coughing, night sweats, unexplained weight loss, and fever.
And that can progress to lung failure, I suppose.
Yes, but TB can also, because it's a bacteria, it can infect anywhere in the body. So it could go to your knee, it could go to your spine, but it most often attacks in the lungs.
Now, it's been reported that TB is the second highest, we have the second highest rate of it after HIV. Are the two linked at all? Do we see higher cases of TB where we see cases of HIV that are also high?
Very much so. So TB is actually the leading killer of people living with HIV/AIDS. And 80% of the cases of TB and HIV occur in sub-Saharan Africa. And we're seeing an emergence of tuberculosis in areas that have been most heavily affected by HIV/AIDS.
Now, one of the cases that we've seen from the Ebola outbreak in Africa has been that when there is an infectious disease outbreak anywhere in the world, that the rest of the world needs to sit up and take notice a lot sooner and to be invested in the containment and treatment of that disease. Is that same case just as applicable for TB as it is for Ebola?
Yes, it's just as applicable for TB. With public health, you get what you pay for. And if you don't invest in proper health systems, and if you don't invest in tuberculosis programs and the new tools that are needed to diagnose and treat the disease, then you're going to continue to have outbreaks around the world, and it's going to remain to be a huge killer, even though it is preventable and treatable, unlike Ebola, which is, at the moment, there is no treatment.
Now, the CDC has reported that the number of TB cases in the United States is at an all-time low of 3 cases per 100,000 people. Who's most likely to be affected by tuberculosis here in the United States?
It really could be anyone. I think over half the cases occur in 4 states, New York, Florida, California, and Texas. So if you live in those states, I think you'd be more likely to get it. But it really, because it lives in your body for so long before you usually get sick, it's hard to tell when you might have picked it up. People who travel tend to be a bit more at risk.
What is the most effective tool that we have in the fight to eradicate TB in the future?
One thing I find very exciting is a new tool to diagnose TB called GeneXpert that is able to diagnose TB in under 2 hours, and it can detect if the disease is resistant to some of the antibiotics used to treat it. And that has been rolled out extensively in South Africa. And as a result, more people are actually getting diagnosed with TB. Now, the problem is we're unable to keep up with the amount of people that are diagnosed and treat them. And the World Health Organization reported in this report today that there are 39,000 people around the world that are on waiting lists for drug-resistant tuberculosis medication.
How would you like to see citizenry, people, governments, health officials reacting to this report from the World Health Organization?
I think people need to react by investing in tuberculosis programming worldwide, not just here, but around the world. Also investing in research and development for new tools. But there are things that average citizens can do to get involved. The organization I work with, Results, is a citizens' grassroots advocacy organization working to empower individuals to exercise their personal and political power for change. And we have chapters throughout Wisconsin, I know in Madison and Milwaukee, as well as many other cities in the United States. And we teach citizens how to become involved in politics and how to engage their elected officials, whether it be on tuberculosis or other diseases of poverty. And so I encourage the listeners to visit results.org and learn how they can get involved.
Mandy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Mandy Slutsker, Senior Associate for Tuberculosis at ACTION, a global health advocacy partnership.
It's time for a weekly look at the inner workings of Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Congress continues to look at the country's response to Ebola, weighing increased funding and how to enact border screenings. We're also 13 days away from midterm elections. Most polls continue to show a Republican takeover of the Senate as likely.
And we'll take a look at diversity in the legislature. This week, Elizabeth Warren spoke up about sexism in the Senate. And when a new crowd moves into Washington after midterm elections, more Latino representatives are expected in their ranks.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. He's USA Today's politics editor. And Paul, it's good to have you back.
Nice to be on. Thanks a lot for having me.
So here we are, 2 weeks away from the midterms. Any seismic shifts or maybe minuscule shifts that we should be aware of as we head in?
Can I come soon enough for me at this point? I don't know, seismic shifts. I mean, I think the number of races are beginning to show some form that may be interesting. We have a new poll out today that we've done in the Colorado Senate race, and it really does show a trend towards the Republican challenger, Cory Gardner. The Democratic incumbent, Mark Udall, has been struggling in that race. And all the polls, ours goes a little further. Ours suggests it's a 6 or 7 point lead for Gardner, but all the polls have been 3, 4, 5% lead for Gardner over the past several weeks. That begins to make you believe that that lead is baking in, and that we just changed our forecast for that race to leans Republican from pure toss-up. So that might be one in the GOP camp at this point.
And how big a deal is that when a race significantly starts to lean toward one direction?
Well, it's a big deal in the sense that this is a race that a year ago Democrats were not at all concerned about. They had a solid incumbent who was well liked, and they did not expect this to be a battleground state. When Congressman Cory Gardner decided to leave the House of Representatives and run for the Senate, suddenly they had a good candidate for the Republicans, and it put that race on the map. So now it's gone from being a race that nobody considered really competitive to one that we now believe the Republicans are in the lead, essentially. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that he's going to win, right? But it certainly means that it's going to take more money for the Democrats to defend if they think they've got a chance. They're going to have to spend for it now a lot more than they would have what we thought they were going to do a year ago.
Senator Elizabeth Warren was in Colorado not long ago stumping for Udall. And when the heavy hitters come in like that, we've got Bill Clinton, for instance, who'll be heading to Wisconsin in the coming days. How big a deal is that? How significant is that in maybe moving the needle for a candidate?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, there's no doubt that it is most valuable for get-out-the-vote efforts, particularly in places with early voting, right? I mean, the Congressional Black Caucus has been down in Louisiana, and they're going to several other states over the past week because early voting has begun there. So if you can get people fired up in a rally and then basically shoot them out the door to the ballot box a couple hours later, that's very helpful. It is a real good get-out-the-vote technique. I don't know that, you know, having an endorsement from Elizabeth Warren helps you sway an undecided voter, right? I mean, it's like anything else. It's sort of hard to know. I will say that in that Colorado race, there was an endorsement from a newspaper that was considered a big deal because, again, it was an endorsement for Gardner, a newspaper that had previously endorsed Udall. It sort of showed the erosion of Udall's support. I don't know that these big sort of, forgive the word, celebrity endorsements matter in that sense of swaying public opinion, but they definitely help sort of galvanize your base and get people to the polls.
On another note, the White House began talks with Congress this week about increasing funding to respond to Ebola. What is the White House looking for from Congress?
We don't know yet. At the moment, they have said that they are well enough supplied, but that they have about $1 billion to play with, and they've spent down, you know, not half of that yet. But it's going to be very clear that starting in December, when the new spending bill is required, that we're going to need to reassess priorities, and they are in negotiations with the House and the Senate appropriators over what would be available and what they're going to do. I mean, they, by and large, lawmakers in both parties, Republicans and Democrats, have said whatever we need to fight this, we will fight, and we will spend to fight Ebola. I just honestly don't know that they yet have a number or they yet know what the priority is. I think part of that's going to depend on seeing how the spread is, or if there is a spread at all in the United States.
Now, judging by media coverage and seeming levels of anxiety, it seems as though last week or maybe the week before was sort of the peak of anxiety about Ebola. Now, based on that, are we still seeing calls to close borders to West African countries?
Yeah. There are still members of Congress who are saying we should close borders to West African countries. We should establish travel bans for anybody flying. And keep in mind that we're not really closing the borders. What we're doing is saying that we will not issue any new visas to countries where, particularly the three countries where there is a real outbreak of Ebola. I believe it's Liberia and Sierra Leone and the third one I'm blanking on at the moment.
Guinea.
Guinea, that's right. The issue there is instead what the administration is doing is beginning to funnel all passengers from those countries through airports, you know, specific airports that have protocols in place. I think there's five airports where you basically, if you're going to be flying to the U.S. from one of those countries, you'd have to come through, aside from passing through various screenings, you'd also have to come through those designated airports. So the administration is taking these calls seriously and is attempting to implement something that they think will calm the fears, but they really don't want to do a full-out visa ban from those countries. But I suspect that there's going to be another hearing on Friday in the House of Representatives. I suspect you'll hear more conversation about that topic then.
Now, is the White House taking hits on this one, or any party in particular?
Well, you know, the White House takes hits because, of course, the White House is in charge. You know, I mean, by definition, whenever things go bad, people start to worry about the competence of the administration. You usually rely on government to solve problems for you, and sometimes they don't. I think certainly when there was a concern about nurses who had been treating an Ebola patient getting on airplanes, flying to Cleveland, and hanging out in a bridal registry shop for 3 hours, you wonder how the heck that's possible. That stuff rebounds really badly on the administration. Now, keep in mind, Obama then canceled a bunch of his own travel, stayed in Washington, and has sort of made every effort to say, I'm engaged. He's meeting today with the new Ebola czar he's appointed, a guy named Ron Klain. The whole idea is to try and establish competence and management to try and sort of back down the public panic. Maybe that helps, maybe it doesn't. I will say, for what it's worth, that there is, you know, I think, tragically, Americans still have relatively short attention spans, and so, you know, a shooting in Canada today is going to be the head of the news. And may bump Ebola off the front pages for a day or two, and then maybe that starts to tamp down some of the fear.
Now, moving on to Senator Elizabeth Warren, she's had some interesting things today, some interesting things to say about sexism in Congress. She said she's experienced it. She cited other women who've experienced sexist remarks in Congress. How has Congress evolved as more women join its ranks?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of sensitivity to this issue, or really more sensitivity to these kinds of issues, you know, over the past decade. You know, I mean, remember 1992, I believe, was the year of the woman. Suddenly we had, you know, a half dozen woman senators we hadn't had before. Now that number is up to, I believe we're in the 15, 16, 17 women senators, maybe up to 20 by next year. You know, so women are becoming an integrated part of the organization, which, by all accounts, has been an old boys club for 200 years. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. But it was 25 years ago that Senator Bob Packwood was finally drummed out of office for a repeated grabbing of staff and, you know, coming on to women. That was sort of the first eye-opening story about gender discrimination and abuse in the Senate. And my suspicion is, like any other place where you're dealing with honestly, a bunch of 70-year-old white men, you are frequently dealing with people who may have still some fairly sexist attitudes and behaviors. I think the Senate is interested, is concerned, I believe that there are a lot of people in the Senate who are aware and trying to do something about this. And by the way, I think there are a lot of members of the Senate, men in the Senate, who really do respect their female colleagues. But I also believe that, like any big organization, you're never going to be able to be done with those kind of behaviors entirely. There will always be a little bit of it.
And Paul, as we wrap up, just real quickly, are we expecting a lot of new women in the Senate, in Congress?
Yeah, you're expecting several new women in the Senate. I know Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia is likely to be a new senator. There are a couple other, we expect another handful of Latino House members. There'll be a slightly larger Latino delegation, as it were, in the Congress next year. I believe we'll have two African-American senators elected at the same time for the first time in our history. So, you know, you're seeing diversity increase in the Congress as you see it increase around the country.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Veronica. Be well.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time for a behind-the-scenes look at the country's legislature.